provinces. The Adana governor confirmed that weapons, ammunition, and chemicals were seized on the raids, but did not confirm Turkish media accounts that sarin gas was found. Turkey's been on high alert since bomb attacks killed 51 people in a border town earlier this month. On Thursday, Turkish soldiers returned fire into Syria when their patrol came under fire in Hatay province. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Istanbul.
Board members for computer maker Dell are in favor of a bid by Michael Dell to take the company private. The board unanimously voted to recommend shareholders accept the company founder's offer of $24.4 billion, or $13.65 a share. But the offer has been criticized by some prominent shareholders, including billionaire investor Carl Icahn. So the shareholder meeting now takes place in mid-July. Another check on Wall Street. The Dow up 7, the Nasdaq down 1. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to a vigorous presence for poetry in American culture. PoetryFoundation.org.
I'm Donda Beard, Director of Development for Illinois Public Media. During June's WILL TV Fund Drive, we are going to be offering some great special pledge programs, as always. But we're especially excited to offer you the opportunity to make a gift to support your favorite regular weekly shows. So whether it's a local show like Mid-American Gardener or an episode of Masterpiece Mystery, your support will help keep all these great programs on the air. Join us for our June TV membership drive from June 1st to June 9th on WILL TV.
Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Ed Kieser was WILL's chief meteorologist for many years, and today you can hear him providing some of the global weather forecasts during our agricultural programming. Nowadays, Ed is based in Ohio, but his position as a visiting lecturer at the University of Illinois brings him back to town from time to time. He's back with us on the phone on Focus today to answer your questions about the weather and explain some of the whys and wherefores behind the weather we're having these days. Ed Kieser, welcome back to Focus.
Oh, it's great to be back, Jim.
And how's the weather in Ohio, by the way?
Not much different than Illinois right now. Warm. We're not quite into the thunderstorms yet. I know there's a bunch of scattered thunderstorms now just to your west. But we're running about a day behind Illinois in terms of that.
And well, first of all, let me say that if you have any questions or comments for Ed Kieser, give us a call. The number is 333-9455. Call toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL for any of your questions about weather subjects. And you can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And you were last on Focus, Ed. You were on Focus with the previous host, Craig Cohen, in early December. And from listening back to the broadcast, it was a beautiful, warm day in Champaign-Urbana in that day in early December. But I don't know, what sort of weather did we get overall in the one that just ended a few months ago, which it seemed to be mild for part of the time anyway?
Well, December was a very mild month, and January, too, did run above average on temperature. Really, the brunt of winter came late in the month of March. Temperatures ran about 5.5 degrees per day below normal, and snowfall for the month of March was, topped out at over 16 inches. So that's more than a foot more than typically falls during the month of March.
I do remember one foot of snow day that came pretty late in the season.
Yeah, it was a very late winter, and my experience has been, this doesn't happen every year, but in most years, it seems like there's one month where winter's wrath really reigns, and sometimes it's very early in the season, December. I can even recall a couple of years where it got extremely cold in November. Other years, obviously January or February, but every once in a while, the winter could be mild, and all of a sudden, March comes along. I think the other thing that's interesting is the contrast between March of 2013 and March of 2012. This year, the temperature ran 5.5 degrees per day below average. In March of 2012, an extraordinary anomaly. Temperatures ran 15.1 degrees per day above average, and that was the warmest March on record, by the way, in 2012. So there was a more than 20-degree swing in temperature from March 2012 to March 2013.
Well, does what happened early in the year have any effect on what happens after that? I mean, did the type of winter we have affect the type of spring we had?
Really, when you get down to it, oftentimes, no. When you look at it statistically, if it's extremely cold in March, the odds do tilt to it staying colder than average in April, but not always. And I guess that's the point to make. If the weather pattern decides to make a shift in April, then we could go from a cold March to a warm April. So when you look at the long-term climate record, statistically speaking, when you go from one season to the next, usually there's not a good signal. You'll have a wide distribution in results looking at past records. So every year is different. Sometimes, with agricultural outlooks, people ask me what this summer would be like, and I would just say it'll be like the summer of 2013. I know that doesn't really give everybody the answer they want to hear, but each year is unique. That's the point I try to make.
So we can't really make a forecast at this point. For instance, last year we had a lot of concerns about drought. I know in Decatur they were taking relatively severe water conservation measures out there because their dependence on Lake Decatur for the reservoir. It's been a pretty wet spring, but does that tell us anything about the summer ahead as far as moisture?
Well, again, it'll come down to the weather patterns, but I can say this. We are not repeating last year. We're not even close to last year going into late spring and summer. So the chances of a repeat performance of last summer are extremely small. So we can make some prognostications into the summer, maybe more so on what it won't do as opposed to what it will do. And a drought of the extremity of what we had last summer is very unlikely this year just because of where we are now. Last year, with that very, very warm and dry March, that kind of set the table for the whole spring and summer. We could still end up with a weather pattern that's dry, but we're going into this summer with a surplus of moisture in the area. So we're not starting out dry. So even if the weather turns dry, it's just you're not going to have as extreme dry conditions as last year.
And I am thinking we certainly have had some flooding in central Illinois during the last few weeks. And I think we may have some flood watches in effect right now matter. Flash flood watch up until 7 p.m. tomorrow night for Douglas, Vermilion, Piatt, Coles, Moultrie, DeWitt, Champaign, and Macon County. So there's the possibility that's just of a flash flood watch happening in what we call the WILL severe weather coverage area for most of it throughout the day.
Yeah, every county is either under a flood watch or flash flood watch right now. And then there's river flood warnings for some areas as well still. So, yeah, the ground is very wet, and so any of the rain coming in, there's going to be showers and thunderstorms moving through over the next couple of days. So any rain that comes in comes down hard. It's going to come down hard on relatively saturated soil, so that makes it easier for flooding, and thus the reason why there are all the watches out there. And it looks like the threat of showers and thunderstorms will continue on through tomorrow, but then some quieter weather comes in later in the weekend.
And I should note that Ford County is also under a flash flood watch until tomorrow night as well. One thing that there's been a fair amount of in the past few weeks, but not really around here, I think, is tornadoes.
Yep, tornado season has gotten underway. It was a slow start to the tornado season this year, which is good. But the number one month for tornadoes in the U.S. is typically May, followed by June in terms of number of tornadoes. So we're right in the heart of tornado season right now. And unfortunately, the tornadoes made news with the violent tornadoes that hit Oklahoma a little over a week ago, around the Moore area in particular. So we're in that season right now, and today there's probably the threat of tornadoes in Oklahoma and to parts of Missouri and northwestern Arkansas, southeastern Kansas later today. You know, there's even a chance that there could be a few as far northeast as Illinois, but the greatest risk area for tornadoes is, again, today centered on Oklahoma.
Well, this is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking about the weather, not doing much about it, but we are talking about it with meteorologist Ed Kieser, and you can call with your weather questions at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Or you can email your questions at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number is again 333-WILL or 1-800-222-WILL. And I'm wondering, Ed, because I'm thinking of the way that the tornadoes clustered around certain days. The more Oklahoma tornado came during, I think, a 3 or 4 day period of a lot of tornado activities. Moore's gotten several tornadoes over the years, as have other certain areas. What makes an area or tornado prone, or what makes a particular weather pattern something that's going to birth a lot of tornadoes?
Well, both of those things are necessary. First, just looking at the geography, the central U.S. is the most tornado-prone part of the world, and it's really based on geography. We have the Gulf of Mexico to the south, and that is the source area for very warm and humid air, which is necessary for thunderstorm and tornado formation. That's the fuel for thunderstorms. And then we have the Rocky Mountains to the west, which kind of acts as a barrier so that moisture doesn't come in from the Pacific Ocean on the west-to-east flow. And so you get a contrast not only between temperature but moisture, very dry air interacting with the warm, moist air. And when you get the weather pattern with a trough of low pressure out near the lee of the Rocky Mountains and a southwest flow on through the Mississippi Valley, Ohio Valley region, that's when the setup is greatest for tornadoes in our part of the country, because that setup, you have the warm, moist air coming up from the Gulf of Mexico, you got low pressure spinning up over the central U.S., and on the backside of that, cold, dry air comes in from Canada, and you also have what we call wind shear, another ingredient necessary for tornado formation, winds near the surface coming out of the south or southeast, but as you go up in the atmosphere a few miles, the winds turn to a more westerly direction, coming more out of the west, and so you get that turning of the winds with height, as well as stronger winds as you go up in the atmosphere. So the geography is the first thing we look at to make this part of the world more tornado-prone than anywhere else. And then you have to have the right weather pattern. And then you even get into the seasons. And while tornadoes can occur at any time of the year, they're more frequent in this time of year because of the jet stream winds. The winds several miles up in the atmosphere are strongest in the winter time and lightest in the later summer. And so the transition seasons, the fall and spring, is when you would expect the jet stream to still be strong enough, but you have that clash of air masses. But you take it a step farther, spring is the time versus fall where you get more tornadoes because the days are getting longer, the sun's higher in the sky, and it's that heating of the ground that helps make that warm, moist air rise to build the massive thunderstorms. So there's a lot of things that come together. And this is the time of year, and this is the part of the world where that happens the most.
Well, I want to follow up on that, but first I want to take a call on line 4. Craig in Park Forest is calling. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Good morning, Mr. Meadows, Mr. Kieser. It's I brings back old memories to hear you. You know, I feel like I should ask you, you know, about my, you know, what the weather's going to be like on my trip to Des Moines in a couple weeks. I remember you used to always do that travel forecast. That was
yeah,
awesome.
Friday mornings, and it's Friday.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you a question about, because I know you've been doing this for a long time, what do you think is the biggest, what's the biggest change you've seen in weather forecasting over the time that you've been in the business? Has it been just the technology or the demands that meteorologists have or the need for immediacy because people want to know, you know, they want to know when a tornado is coming, you know, or people expect that there's going to be a warning for a tornado to be much more accurate than it was, as I recall, when I was growing up. So I was just kind of wondering what your thoughts were on that, kind of what's the biggest change you've seen.
Well, Ed, I think some of what you note is a result of the changes. Talking about the demands and the immediacy and the details, a lot of that is expected now more than it was, say, 25 years ago, because we're better able to answer those questions. So I think as the technology has improved, the expectations of the information that we provide has gone up along with that. So those two go hand in hand. So the biggest change I've seen over the last 30 years, basically, I've answered it this way for several years now, but it still applies. When I first came to WILL, I was looking for as much data as possible to make my forecast. I would go over to the Atmospheric Sciences Department building and twice a day to look at some maps that came off this expensive but rather slow map printer, and look at the maps and get my hands on anything I could to make a weather forecast. In my later years at WILL, and this applies to today as well, it was more of a question of deciding what data to look at, because there was so much data out there that you couldn't look at everything. That's how much the technology has exploded, the delivering of data. So that's the biggest change, is the technology has really exponentially increased what we have to look at now compared to a few decades ago.
Okay, well, thank you. I appreciate your taking my question, and I hope you'll both have a good day.
Well, thank you. You too. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much, Craig. You know, one thing that I was struck by with the recent Moore tornado is that I saw it on television. I saw it on television live, and that was just absolutely chilling to know that that was bearing down on the Oklahoma City area as I was watching. And if it was chilling for me, I can't imagine what it was like for people in the area to see that huge funnel cloud on their TV screens.
Absolutely, and that is something that's different compared to even 5-10 years ago. I did the same thing as you did. Actually, I was at home looking at weather information on my computer, and I saw tornado emergency issued for Moore in Oklahoma City. So I just went over to my television, turned it on, and did what you did. I watched it live. I figured, well, they'll have it. You know, 5-10 years ago, I wouldn't have expected that even. But there's so many tower cams now, and of course, some of the stations in Oklahoma City had helicopters out there, and thank goodness all the helicopter pilots stayed out of harm's way, which is not easy to do on a tornado day, because sometimes new storms start to develop in the vicinity of existing storms, and they could end up in real trouble. It's really not a safe thing to be flying helicopters near those storms. 2 years ago, too, on April 27th, when there was the huge outbreak of tornadoes in the south, there again, I watched live coverage from Tuscaloosa and Birmingham, Alabama. So that is something that's changed. I think it is helpful, actually, when you can see that, because through my experience, there are so many warnings that are issued. I think a lot of people are complacent unless they feel the true emergency. And if you see a large wedge tornado heading toward your neighborhood, even on TV, that gets your attention rather quickly. And so I think the coverage is good in that, in terms of, I think it really told people, hey, this is the real one. You really need to take cover now. But that is something that's changed with the technology and the 24/7 news cycle and multiple channels on cable and satellite and the web. So, yeah, those things are there now that used to not be there.
That also means, you know, in this case, one reason all these cameras were there to watch it, one reason anyway, is because it hit an urban area or a relatively urban area. My memory tells me that tornadoes used to hit relatively, countryside, small towns, you know, at most. I think of Plainfield. Plainfield's a city, but it's not that big a city. Does the build up in urban areas make any difference as far as weather conditions for a tornado?
No, actually, I don't think it makes a difference at all in terms of causing tornadoes to form, or in other cases causing tornadoes not to form. Some people think they're protected in cities. But with the urban sprawl, the expansion of urban areas, the odds of a populated area getting hit by a tornado increases. But still, it's rather small, and we hear about the tornadoes that cause the devastation, which are the ones that do hit populated areas. And, for example, you could just look at Champaign County, Illinois. I like to use this illustration. Champaign-Urbana, pretty big in Champaign County, Illinois. And if you go west to east across Champaign-Urbana, you're maybe traveling about, 7 miles, let's say. If you go north-south, it's really only about a four-mile swath where most of the population is, maybe a little more than that. But let's just say it's 7 miles wide and 4 miles tall, Champaign-Urbana. 7 times 4, 28. 28 square miles. So we could add a little bit to that, and we'll say Champaign-Urbana is about 35 square miles in size. Champaign County is just over 1,000 square miles. So there are some other population centers in Champaign County, but I think you might be getting to where I'm going here. Only 35 out of 1,000 is that high population density area of Champaign County. So the odds of a big tornado hitting Champaign County are still very small that they'll go through the city. That's not to say it can't happen, but it's all a statistical odds sort of thing when you look at that. And if we have time a little later, we could talk a little bit about Moore, because unfortunately they're the anomaly by far on statistics and odds of getting hit. They've been hit by two EF5 tornadoes in 14 years. That's just extraordinary, extraordinarily bad, extraordinarily unfortunate, because EF5 tornadoes are easy to count because they are so rare and so devastating. And since 1950, there's only been 59 EF5 or F5 tornadoes in the U.S., and that's over a span of almost 64 years. So there's, on average, just slightly less than one EF5 tornado a year. So to have two of them hit the same town is just, the odds of that are extremely small. So,
is there anything special about the terrain or the climate in Moore's location that would just make that general area more likely to be hit by a powerful tornado?
Well, Oklahoma is the most tornado-prone state in the country in terms of tornado density, but the odds of two EF5 tornadoes hitting anywhere are very, very small. So Moore is very unlucky to have that happen, and it's likely that that won't happen a third time, but you can't say it won't. But and they also had in between those two EF5 tornadoes, the one in 99 and the one that we had here just back on May 20th, in between those two, there was another rather strong tornado that went through in 2003. So the Oklahoma City area is the urban area in the U.S. that is most likely to have tornadoes out of any, but still to have two EF5s hit Moore is extraordinary, because there's less than one per year in the U.S. on average, so anywhere in the U.S. So that just, what that says is a couple things. One, you know, with statistically, your odds of getting hit by a tornado are small, but there are anomalies even within statistics, and so anything is possible.
Well, as far as tornado season, spring is certainly it, but how far into the summer do we expect this sort of likelihood of tornadoes to go?
Well, the tornado season for central Illinois usually gets going. The beginning date varies from year to year, but statistically it's April, May, and June. So if you really start to become aware in March and you keep your awareness up a little past June, you probably cover the majority of tornadoes. And May is the number one month in terms of number of tornadoes. June is number two. However, when you talk about the strong and violent tornadoes, there's a higher likelihood of those occurring early season, late March, April, into May, than in June. So right now we're probably just a little past the middle of tornado season in Illinois. And anytime as we go through the rest of the summer, tornadoes are possible. Actually, tornadoes are possible in any month, but the likelihood goes way down as we get into the second half of summer.
Well, maybe this is a good time to go through some of the basics about what people should remember, and it really is what you can remember during a panicky situation when if a tornado should strike.
Well, there's you want to be in a building. You don't want to be in a vehicle or a mobile home. The vehicles and mobile homes are the two worst places to be. So we'll just use the premise tornado is threatening, so you get to a building. There's two rules to remember. Because every building is different, you want to go to the lowest floor possible in a building. So if there's a basement, go to the basement. If they don't have a basement, go to the first floor. Getting low is important. And the other rule is put as many walls between you and the tornado, you and the outside, as possible. And that way, if you're in the middle of a building on the lowest floor, your protection is much better than if you're up high or on the outer walls. And certainly you don't want to be near any windows because flying debris is what hurts and kills more people than anything else. And, of course, windows are made of glass that breaks. So stay away from those windows for sure. So lowest floor and put as many walls between you and the outside as possible. Those are the two things you should remember wherever you are. And for your home, you should take those principles and apply them to finding the best place in your home ahead of time so you instinctively go there if a tornado is threatening. And the same thing where you work too, or school. That's probably a good thing too. Of course, in some places they have tornado procedures and you follow what is prescribed for those particular buildings. Of course, I'll tell people if they're in a shopping mall, for example, you know, you're usually not allowed in the back office, but if you're in a big store and a tornado's threatening, just push your way into a small room in the back or the bathroom and don't worry about what the management says in those cases.
You can apologize later.
You just want to protect your life in those cases because really you're very vulnerable if you're in any building that has a large span roof and lots of glass, which most stores have.
So being in the, you know, being in the actual mall part of an indoor mall, the open courtyard, even though there may be a lot of walls between you and the outside, that's not really the best place.
No, because the larger the span of the roof, the greater chance it has to collapse. And, you know, some people that are severely injured or killed in tornadoes, it happens when large beams fall on them and crush them. You know, that's why we recommend smaller interior rooms, because you just have better structure around you.
Okay, let's take a short break right now. We'll be back in a moment with more on the weather with meteorologist Ed Kieser talking about the weather and answering your questions. This is Focus on WYLL.
Jury selection in the federal racketeering trial of the legendary Boston criminal Whitey Bulger begins next week. Bulger was wanted for 19 murders when he was captured in 2011 after 16 years on the lam. Bulger was also an informant and got protection from the FBI. On the next Fresh Air, two journalists who've covered his story join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of foods from around the world, including cheeses, olives, spices, hot sauces, olive oils, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
I'm Jim Meadows. We're back on Focus with meteorologist Ed Kieser, whose history with WYLL goes back, well, decades. And glad to have you on Focus again.
Well, it's a lot of fun. It's great to be back.
And you are also something that brings you back around here is you are also a visiting lecturer with the University of Illinois. I think you taught some courses last fall.
I taught a course in broadcast journalism, and may or may not be doing that in the near term here, depending on enrollment. Sometimes summer enrollment's a little lower, but on occasion I'm teaching broadcast meteorology.
Well, your chance to take a course with Ed Kieser. Which part of the university should they contact if somebody's curious about this?
Well, the Department of Journalism. Sometimes we cross-list the class with the Atmospheric Sciences Department, and I do teach that class online, so you can be anywhere to take it.
Okay. I'm wondering, we were talking about tornado safety. I'm wondering about the Moore tornado, which was a really powerful tornado, the only EF5 we've had, I guess, at least in North America this year so far. Relatively low loss of life. I mean, actually, about 24 people died, which is terrible, but it sounds like it could have been a lot worse. And there were, I think, about 300 people injured. Is there any understanding why things were not worse in terms of lives lost and people injured?
I would say Central Oklahoma has probably got the best educated population in terms of tornadoes in the country. Not only that tornado, but the outbreak of tornadoes they had on May 3rd of 1999, where there were there was a slightly higher loss of life, but there were also more tornadoes that day. Those are the exceptions. Most years in Oklahoma, the tornado fatality count is extremely low, if not zero, and it's really getting into those violent tornadoes, the EF4, EF5 category, where sometimes your survival just comes down to luck, because those types of tornadoes are not survivable unless you're underground or very well protected in a tornado shelter. And so, yeah, the 24 killed, that's a terrible number, but it's really extraordinary that it wasn't worse because of the devastation that occurred throughout the city of Moore. And it really just comes down to tornado education. And a lot of research now in tornado safety is turning more to the social science of how people react to various forms of information when weather threatens. And a little bit that I've read on that is that people tend to want to have a little bit of confirmation on things before they actually take action. So just a radio station or the National Weather Service saying there's a tornado warning usually doesn't do it. Ground truth, I've found, often motivates people more. So if you hear that there is actually a tornado doing damage in a certain place and moving in a certain direction, people are more likely to take cover than if it's, well, Doppler radar indicates rotation that will likely produce a tornado in this area.
So those TV pictures of the tornado in Moore, coming down on Moore may have actually made a difference there.
I think that probably did make a difference, not only in terms of the people that saw it taking cover, but some then emailing, Facebooking, or tweeting their friends and saying, hey, there's a huge tornado coming. Take cover immediately. Now, with this tornado and also the one in 1999, there were indications a couple days in advance that it could be a bad tornado day. So that's the other thing. People were a little bit more ready to seek out information, pay closer attention during the course of the day, and that's what you should do when there's a watch issued. You should be paying attention to rapidly changing conditions. And then once the storms formed, information was being provided not only by those seeing the tornado, but the National Weather Service was issuing strongly worded messages, tornado emergency messages, in fact, once it was clear that there was a tornado that was moving toward the populated area. So all of those things, and the combination of all of those things got people prepared and taking cover in places that they should. And really, they're at a little bit of a handicap in central Oklahoma as well, because the in terms of where the bedrock is, it's not far below the soil. So most buildings do not have basements out there. And when you get an EF4 or EF5 tornado, you are best protected if you're underground. But there's a lot of buildings where you can't get underground. So that says something, too, for the people living out there, heeding the warnings and doing the right thing. And I think that this is a good example of a situation that was a devastating disaster, but could have been much, much worse if the population wasn't educated and hadn't done the right thing.
Well, we have three phone calls lined up now. Let's get started with Linda on line one, Linda in Urbana. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Thank you. I just wanted to say thanks for all you and your crew's wonderful weather reporting, the accuracy and the frequency of it. And I can remember having a tornado tote bag kit and grabbing it with water and a couple of protein bars and my radio and some batteries and zipping downstairs and lying on the floor wondering if you were okay broadcasting live to us and telling me when I could come up and look around and finding out that trees had fallen down in my neighborhood and branches. I just really do miss it, and I really appreciated it. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for the nice comments. And it sounds like you were well prepared because you had a little tote bag to take things with you for the long haul. And I've talked to a lot of people who lived through tornadoes, and that just made me think of something. A lot of people tell me, have a good pair of shoes nearby. For some reason, a lot of people end up running to their tornado shelter without wearing shoes, and if they're hit, oh, boy, do you want to have shoes on when you...
Well, I just learned something new with putting my tote bag. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and also the other thing I've talked to about people, you know, you can replace most of your possessions, but the one thing that it's hard to replace are those personal mementos such as pictures. So I know some people that like to keep their pictures in a place where the tornado threat is less.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Linda. And let's go ahead to line two. Line two, Steve in Kankakee, you're on the air on Focus.
Yes, I have two questions. One about the Moore tornado. Why were the early reports of the number of deaths so far off, so high? And secondly, what do you think about these radios you can get warnings of thunderstorm activity or tornadoes? I'll listen off the air.
Okay.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, I don't know why the report of the death toll was so high in the beginning. And I've noticed that a lot with various disasters. It's probably a duplication issue where some people are counted more than once. But I did go to bed that night reading something where it said the medical examiner said there were 51 dead. And so, you know, I was delighted to hear that the number came way down the next day. But that's still, it's unfortunate that such inaccurate information somehow got out there. But in terms of why, you know, I can't comment on that because I wasn't there and not close to the situation. But it does seem that there's a problem with that, and I think it goes to everybody wants information instantaneously right now, and sometimes with certain organizations wanting to be first with the information, inaccurate information gets out there more so than in the past. But in this particular case, I don't know why the discrepancy was so high. In terms of weather radios, it really is a good idea to have a tone alert weather radio for the nighttime.
Now, a tone alert, is that a type of radio or a brand of radio?
It's a type of radio. There are many companies that make these types of radios. I know you can get them. Well, Midland is one company. Radio Shack sells weather radios. There are a variety of weather radios. These are continuous weather broadcasts from the National Weather Service. But the tone alert weather radio is one that a tone will be activated when a warning is issued. Now, what I recommend, you have to spend a little more money, but usually in the $30 to $40 range, you get a tone alert weather radio with SAME, S-A-M-E technology. That's specific area message encoding technology. Then you can program the radio to sound alerts only for your county, or if you prefer your county and maybe the one just to your west. So it's not waking you up for every warning and watch within the radio station's coverage area. It's just going off for warnings for your specific area. And so that cuts down on the number of times you're awakened in the middle of the night. But That is one risk, is when severe weather occurs in the middle of the night. It doesn't happen often, but when it does, the risk of loss of life is higher because people are just less aware in the middle of the night.
And having some sort of high-pitched or piercing tone, something that's going to wake you up, is useful than just having the voice on the radio.
And if you live in a tornado-prone building... And when I say that, maybe a mobile home or a building that's a modular construction, or, you know, living up high in a place where you're more tornado prone as opposed to, say, living in the basement, you know, that's probably more important to you, too. So what you want to do is just minimize your risk, and you can do that with these radios. And again, about $30 to $40, and they're sold in in many stores. I've seen them in drug stores, of course, electronics stores, and department stores, too, some department stores. So they're out there, and also online. You can just Google Tone Alert Weather Radios and find them.
Let's go to line four, Jeff in Piatone. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Hey, good morning. There's a lot of good stuff on this. I'm glad that you guys are doing it, especially this time of year. I want to actually ask a question and add a couple comments, if I may. Well, first I'll ask you the question, and I'll add the comments if I can. I keep hearing reports that this may be our, you know, north central Illinois is overdue for a tornado. And I wanted to know, is there, you know, do you guys look at decades or, you know, maybe every 10 years or every 15 years on cycles, if we get an outbreak of tornadoes one particular time versus another, does it make a difference?
My feeling is, well, it gets back, part of it is you can look at the statistics, and that's where people probably say overdue. And it's one of those things where there are a lot of anomalies in what you would maybe think is the normal occurrence rate of every 10 or every 20 years or so on. You could have back-to-back years with really bad weather, and then you could go a few decades with no tornadoes in the area. That's possible. Or it could come along where every 5 to 10 years there's a tornado in a certain area. So there's a lot of variability in that. And it really just comes down to the weather pattern in the particular times of year, the weather pattern being such that promote tornadoes in the spring, or that's the time of year where they're most likely to be the strongest. But even with that, you know, sometimes you get violent tornadoes at other times of the year, and I'll share in a moment a statistic on EF5 and F5 tornadoes in Illinois. There have been two since 1950, and both of them have occurred out of season. So in terms of northern and central Illinois, if you've gone a long period of time without any strong or violent tornadoes, then I guess you could say maybe the area is overdue, but that doesn't mean that one is imminent. But you've always got to be aware of the fact that sort of thing could happen. And then you might get into a period where over a five-year period there might be a few events in the area. And then all of a sudden your perception is, wow, things have gotten a lot worse, and we're getting tornadoes all the time now. And really a lot of it just comes down to perceptions, and statistically there's a lot of variability in these occurrences. So all I could say for somebody living in your area is you might statistically be overdue, but you might go another 10 years without a problem in the area, or things may change here in the next couple of years, and you might have a few big tornadoes within 50 miles of your house over the next few years.
Well, I live close to the one in Plainfield. That was about 5 miles away from that when that happened. So I'm aware of what damage it can do. But the other things I want to tell people is I've learned this because I do training for tornadoes. I'm a tornado spotter up in the town I'm at. So, I mean, I keep on top of it every year. I go every year and just to refresh, even though I know it. But in my house, in my basement, I want to know where the electrical and the gas and the water setoffs are. And the first thing, if you see one, and I've heard this from stories after stories about people in their houses, they're in the basements, I tend to go and shut everything off, the gas, the water, and the, you know, at least the gas and the electric, because if you're down there and that thing goes through, you could spark a fire and you're trapped. The other thing is, it just seems to me, if you live in an area that's prone for tornadoes, why you don't have a basement or a tornado shelter beats the heck out of me. And you know, Oklahoma, I commend the governor for making it, they're trying to make it a mandatory thing, because I'm an ex-firefighter from California, been out here for years, but I could tell you stories about stuff that people didn't do, even though they should have done it because of the right thing, just because they didn't want to spend the money, or if they were lazy. Now, people need to wake up, and I say smell the roses in this case, because it can save lives if you have some kind of shelter. Thanks, guys. Great show. Love it.
And I will say, while there's a focus on those that didn't have shelter in Oklahoma, there's not the focus on the many people that already did. And that is partly why the loss of life was lower than maybe expected out in Oklahoma, because people there did take precautions. Now, you go into other parts of the country, and it's a much different story. And since you mentioned the Plainfield tornado, that's the last F5 tornado to hit Illinois, and that occurred on August 28th of 1990.
So that is sort of out of season for...
Yeah, in fact, I think since 1950, that's the only August F5 or EF5 tornado in the United States.
We're talking to meteorologist Ed Kieser about the weather on Focus on WILL. Let's take another call. Line 1, Steve in Beecher. You're on the air on Focus.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Joined the conversation a little late, so I don't know if this was covered or not. But two quick questions. With regards to the Moore, Oklahoma, there had been some discussion, not of underground shelters, but of something called a safe room, which is actually, I guess, in the middle of the house. Was wondering if Ed had any knowledge about that as far as cost or what it's made out of. And then the other thing is, and this has been discussed over a number of years, I guess it's a fallacy with regards to Chicago. The argument was made, well, because of its proximity to the lake, they don't get tornadoes. And it's my understanding that's got no effect on it at all. Actually, it's just, I guess, a matter of luck. And I was wondering if Ed wanted to comment on either one of those. Thanks a lot.
I can comment on both. I'm no expert on safe rooms in terms of where you buy them. There's people that sell them. I can tell you this, though. A lot of people in Oklahoma that have built houses in the last few decades have them built into their house when the house is built. And they do add several thousand dollars to the cost of the house. I think I heard actually on an NPR story recently that maybe it's about $5,000, which probably is worth it if you live out in that part of the country. And back in I worked on a tornado project for a couple weeks back in the mid-1990s, and a friend of mine lived in Norman and just built a house at the time. So he showed me his, and what it was the coat closet inside the house was his safe room. And what they did there is they just, it's a room made out of concrete with rebar, the beams in there to make it just very solid. And it doesn't make the house look any worse because it's a closet, and that's what a lot of the safe rooms are in houses that are built today. It's just maybe a little bit larger size closet. Of course, now with that closet, you want to have enough space in there, not fill it up with junk so that you can actually get in there and use it if a tornado threatens. But that's what a lot of people are doing when they build new homes. You can have these safe rooms added to existing homes as well. But that's what a lot of people do out there because of the issues of not having basements.
When it comes to big urban areas like Chicago, which are near lakes, does the proximity of a lake mean anything as far as a likelihood of a tornado?
The proximity of a lake certainly does affect the weather. Now, in terms of Chicago specifically, generally tornadoes will come from a westerly direction. More often or not, from the southwest in the early spring, more west to northwest as you get into later in the season. And that's away from the lake. So tornadoes that would affect Chicago would not form over the lake. They would be forming out to the west and coming into the city. And they come off of very strong storms that don't just suddenly weaken before hitting the city usually. If the storm is strong enough to produce a strong or violent tornado, that tornado will last. And we've had reports of tornadoes making it all the way to the Lake Michigan shoreline in the past. And you could go back to 1967, the storm that hit Oak Lawn and did go through the south side of Chicago. The reports of that tornado were that it went all the way to Lake Michigan. With any damage path, there's going to be areas where the damage is worse than others. And in that particular tornado, the worst of it was a bit west of Lake Michigan, but still, that hit a populated area in Chicago. The reason that you don't hear about more tornadoes hitting Chicago or any other city gets back to the square miles of land out there versus the square miles that are populated. And it's just the odds. It comes down to an odds thing. And more tornadoes than not are going to hit less densely populated areas because there's a lot more landscape that's less densely populated. But that does not protect a city at all. All cities in the Midwest are prone to tornadoes, and they can and do sometimes occur.
Okay. Well, I wanted to thank Steve for that question. Maybe our final question for the morning that came in on email, and that was just a question wondering if any larger climate phenomena, whether climate change or what have you, is having an impact having a noticeable impact on the weather, whether it's more tornadoes or more extremes of weather or what have you.
With climate change over the last few decades, in central Illinois in particular, the Midwest in general, there have been some notable changes in some weather parameters and no change in others. And probably the most notable change is the higher frequency of heavy rain events. We've had more cases of flooding in the last 30 years than prior to that. And it seems that there are, well, when I say seems, we can look at it statistically. There are more cases of heavy rainfall occurring than in the past. That appears to be a significant climate change signal. On the other hand, there are some things that have not changed much at all, including heat waves so far. Last year we had very hot weather, but that was in large part due to the flash drought that we had, and when the ground is very dry in the summertime, we tend to have our hottest weather. We had 55 days, I believe, where it got to 90 or higher last year, which was one short of the record of 56 during the drought of 88 and also back in the Dust Bowl of 1936. So we're not seeing so far more of that. And when we get back to tornadoes, there are more tornadoes reported in the U.S. now than a few decades ago, but a lot of that, I think, has to do with just more tornadoes being seen as people are out chasing them and the population centers expand. But because all of the tornado numbers, all the increase in the number of tornadoes cited is in the low-end tornadoes, the ones that last a very short period of time and aren't very strong. The number of violent tornadoes hasn't changed at all, really. So we're not seeing a change to violent tornadoes increasing, at least not yet. We have a couple years that are big. 2011, 2 years ago, was a huge year for tornadoes. But we've had other years such as 1974, 1953, and then you go back before that, there are some notable years as well. So every once in a while, you'll have the atmospheric conditions set up just right with the weather pattern where it's a violent year. And unfortunately, 2 years ago was the worst one in the modern era of record keeping since 1950. But it was not the number one year for fatalities of all time, but it was certainly the worst one in the memory of most people. So that's still an anomaly compared to what we're seeing in other years right now. That's not to say things won't change going forward, but right now we're just looking at probably heavy rainfall as the biggest signal of climate change in central Illinois.
Well, Ed Keyser, we are just about out of time. But I wanted to thank you for coming on the show on Focus today to talk about the weather, and I hope we can do it again soon.
Oh, I hope so, too. It was a lot of fun. Thanks.
Thank you, Ed. This is Focus on WYLL.
Support for today's broadcast comes from ADM. Their FarmerView mobile site features up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids, and offers ADM customers access to contracts, deliveries, and payments. Available at adm.com/farmerview.
Good Friday morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where heading into the final few hours of trading for this day as well as for the month. It appears all systems are go with just about every contract we look at, with the exception of the feeder cattle showing green on the screen. You look at technical charts, both November soybeans and December corn, both are in strong positions to put in higher monthly closes, and in this past week have popped above some key technical moving averages as well. And let's go ahead and look at particulars. We'll begin in the wheat pit, where even that is in green after the announcement earlier this week that some GMO wheat was found in Oregon. We seem to shake that off as well. July wheat, 746 and three quarters, up three quarters. In December, at 775 and a quarter, up one and a quarter. July wheat in Chicago, at 699 and three quarters, up one. In December, at 724, up a half. July corn, 663, up eight and three 3/4. December, 569, up 6 1/4. July soybeans, 15 15 3/4, up 20. November, 13 10, up 20 3/4. July soybean meal, 447.90, up 7.10. July soybean oil, 48.66, up 8 cents. June live cattle, 120.77.5, up 42.5. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. It's 11 o'clock Central Time.